Welcome to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Monday. Today on the show, we're going to talk about an industry that is fundamental to our very existence. It feeds us and clothes us, puts fuel in our cars, brings us our phones and computers, the headphones I'm wearing, the microphone I'm speaking to you through, just about anything you can put a price tag on. The industry is shipping. And in her new book, 90% of Everything, journalist Rose George opens up the hidden world of life at sea, how it's changed for the people inside it, and how it's changed the way we live, even if we almost never think about it. Rose George tells this story through a journey she took on the Maersk Kendall, a container ship on its regular journey from England to Singapore. But this book brings in a huge amount of other research and reporting beyond that experience into piracy, working conditions for sailors, the transformation of the industry since the 1960s, its impact on marine life and global warming, and much more. Rose George joins us on the phone from France. Rose, thank you so much for this book, and welcome to Your Call.
Thank you very much.
And I should also say that Rose is the author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. Her reporting has appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, The Scientific American, and The New Yorker. She actually has a new piece about the struggle against piracy that's at NewYorker.com right now. You can find a link to that at our website, yourcallradio.org. And given that we have the country's fifth largest container port right here in the Bay Area, the Port of Oakland, I do want to say that if you are someone who knows the shipping industry from the inside, we'd welcome hearing your observations on how it's changed and what people on the outside should understand about how it works. And if you're like me, somebody who's simply seen ships pass by stacked with containers that say Costco or Sealand or Maersk and wonders, hey, what's in there and where is it headed? I invite you to stay tuned to this conversation. And if you have questions for Rose George along the way, you can join us at 866-798-TALK. Or you can always email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Rose, the subtitle of your book, 90% of Everything, calls shipping the invisible industry. Could you just, for people who haven't read the book and dug into this in the way that you have, give us a little sense of the scale of this industry and a couple of the reasons why it is something so few people know about?
Well, the simple answer is that shipping, even though we think of it as kind of a historic thing, maybe we think of old ships and salty sea dog captains and pirates, but in fact, it's this incredibly modern and fundamental industry now carries 90% of world trade, hence the title of my book. So it is as fundamental, in fact, probably more so than it's ever been. And even though we may think that things come by air, really very little does. Mail comes by air, perishable fruit may come by air, flowers sometimes come by air, but really otherwise most manufacturers are going to want to ship because it's so cheap.
And so, and talk about why, so for something that's so huge and why is it that so many people know so little about this industry? I mean, you know, it's obviously everything we're wearing, pretty much all the consumer goods we use every day come this way, and yet people can't even name, well, hey, what are the big companies in shipping?
It's a thing that's happened over the last 60 years. So after sort of Second World War, shipping really began to change dramatically, and it changed in two major ways. One way was that it began to use what some people call the flag of convenience. So after the Second World War, for example, the United States had one of the biggest shipping fleets in the world, a lot of American seafarers, and now it has about 100 foreign-going ocean, deep ocean ships, and the number of American seafarers has diminished dramatically. Same has happened in the UK. We now have fewer than 20,000. We used to have 150,000 seafarers. So practically, Americans and Europeans will now not really know a working seafarer. Now, the other issue, the other great change in shipping was the container, the rise of the box, and that happened around the same time. And as containerization developed and it became really efficient, it became a very popular method of transport. But the ships got a lot bigger. And so when they got bigger, they needed bigger ports. And often these ports couldn't be in the center of cities anymore, so you don't see container ships coming into the center of Manhattan anymore. the wharves of Manhattan. You don't see them coming to the center of London. They're now out in Tilbury or New Jersey. I think Oakland and Long Beach are a bit different because they are quite near the cities, but we just don't see these ports anymore, and they're also very secure. They're behind gates and security guards, and you can't really wander into the world of shipping.
And the companies that are involved in this, for the most part, they kind of want it that way, right?
Some of them do. I mean, the company I sailed with, Maersk, is the biggest container shipping company in the world, and it is a huge company. And its revenues are the same as Microsoft's. But really, you know, we all know the name Microsoft, but not that many of us know the name Maersk, but it's as fundamental. But Maersk is different. Maersk is very good at, has become very good at having a public face. It's very active on social media. But it's very much the exception because much of the shipping industry does keep itself to itself. And I know a shipping correspondent who told me that she tried for years to get the Greek Ship Owners Association to tell her how many members it had, and it just wouldn't. Now, that kind of lack of transparency.
Right, even the number of people in the association, right?
Yes, it just wouldn't tell her. And she tried, and she was very well connected, and she couldn't manage to get them to tell her. So that kind of inward-looking behavior, even though I've met plenty of shipping people who say, well, you know, the public misunderstands us, nobody understands how fundamental we are, but they're just not very good at publicizing themselves either.
Well, this book, 90% of Everything, which is Rose George's new book. Rose George is our guest here on Your Call today. If you want to kind of get inside this world of really, it's just a huge global industry, and obviously that ties together so many different things. And Rose, I wanted to, when you're talking about the containerization, this kind of ability to put no matter what you're putting on a ship, it goes in the same kind of box. And I thought it was fascinating learning that a lot of the people who are on the ships have no idea what's in the boxes that they're taking on and putting on and taking off, right?
No, they haven't. On my ship, Maersk Handel, the captain did not know what was in most of the boxes. He probably could have found out. He could have got the manifest from the shore office, but it would have been probably the size of a Bible. I mean, he had like 7,000 boxes on the ship. And the first officer was in charge of all these boxes, and he didn't know what was in them. He knew what was in the... He had a list of the hazardous materials, things that might react, might catch fire. And so we knew what that was, and we had lists of chemicals that were being carried, and we could guess what was in the ship. So if it said battery acid, maybe it was cars going to Asia. But there was no manifest kept on board. But the other thing is that they weren't that curious. They're so used to shifting these boxes from A to B every single month on the same loop that they really didn't care anymore.
Well, actually, so when you go on this trip with the Maersk Handel, this cargo ship going from England to Singapore, you know, one of your primary guides on this is a man you call Captain Glenn, and he is someone who in his career really saw a huge transformation in this industry. Talk a little bit about kind of what he saw as having changed over that time and having been lost in the experience of the people on the ships.
Well, Glenn was is a British guy who had at the time was a senior captain in the Maersk fleet, and he'd been at sea for 42 years. And when he told me that, my ears sort of pricked up because I thought, well, that's pretty much the same chronology as the dramatic changes in shipping. So I started interviewing him every day, and he told me that when he'd started as a junior cadet, which is like an apprentice on the ship, he was on a general cargo ship. So it took quite a long time to unload because there were lots of boxes and crates and cranes, and it could take a week or so to unload the ship. So it was hard work, but he made it sound like a lot of fun. And he had lots of stories about port cities and what goes on in the docks, and some of them publishable, some of them not. But he slowly saw, he remembers seeing his first containers and some of his crewmates saying, oh, they'll never catch on. But they did, and so his shipping life changed dramatically because now, when we went to sea in 2010, for example, as he said to me, you know, I used to wonder if I had time to go ashore for lunch, and now I don't even know if I have time for a newspaper. Because these huge container ships can be in and out of port, can unload and load in less than 24 hours. It's so mechanized and so efficient. And that may make for a very efficient, cheap industry, but it doesn't leave much time for shore leave or rest and relaxation for crews.
And I have to say, one of the things that jumped out to me, it's just a thing you say in passing in the book, is that Maersk has actually has made a policy that, people on the ship can't drink alcohol, and not just while they're on the ship, even when they go on shore.
No, they can't. They did that about 3 or 4 years ago. And I understand the reasoning. You know, you don't want someone drunk in charge of a multi-million pound ship. And there have been accidents relating to alcohol. People have fallen in the water at the dock, and one ship hit the pier in Southend in England. But it was not a popular rule, I must say, because people did unwind at the end of the day over a beer, and they need something to unwind, not necessarily alcohol, but it was a nice thing to come around at the end of the day, just to have a beer. And I think the crew definitely missed it. Now, that's just Maersk's policy. That's not true on many other companies. But yes, they were also not allowed to drink ashore, and they were not allowed to drink even on, flying to meet their ship. So flying from, say, the Philippines, they could not drink on the plane. So it's a very strict policy.
So you talked a little bit about the captain who you spend a lot of time with and we're interviewing on a daily basis. But the crew as a whole is what, 21, 22 people, is that right?
It was 21 people. That included two cadets. It was 22 including me. 21 people, including two young British apprentices, and then 18 men and one woman, because the cook was a woman, Pinky, Filipina woman, on an absolutely massive ship, on a ship that was three soccer fields long and enormous. But they're so efficient and mechanized that they don't really need much crew anymore.
But those crew that are there are working a lot.
They're working a lot. They're exhausted. I mean, I say in my book that, the two men who came to meet me at Felixstowe were pretty typical in that they were Asian, they were Filipino, and they looked exhausted. Because there are 1.5 million seafarers, and a quarter of those are Filipinos. Because, in their words, we are cheap and we speak good English. On a ship now, on an average ship now, you're going to find probably five or six at least nationalities. And, for example, around my dining table in the officer's room, I was sitting next to a Burmese guy, opposite a Romanian, a Moldavian, an Indian, a Brit, another Romanian, and then behind me, Chinese. And then in the crew room, where it was entirely Filipino. And that's pretty typical ship.
So just give us some historical contrast. Say, compared to when, compared to 40 years ago, a ship of that size, how many people might be working on it? Do you have a sense of how much that's changed? And also give us a little sense of how it's changed, who is on the ship?
I don't have exact numbers, but I know there weren't ships that size 40 or 50 years ago.
But smaller ships would have a larger crew.
Smaller ships would have a larger crew. I don't remember what Glenn told me about the ships he started on, but he said it was easier. I mean, it was hard work, but there was proper sort of time for relaxation and pleasure and time ashore. I think the crucial difference is that there isn't enough time for relaxation ashore anymore.
I want to invite listeners to join the conversation. We're speaking with Rose George, author of 90% of Everything Inside Shipping, The Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. Right now, we're talking a little bit about what life is like on a modern-day cargo ship and how this industry has changed over time. We're also going to be talking about piracy, environmental impacts of shipping, and also looking at more questions about workers and their conditions. If you have questions about the ships that you've seen pass through the San Francisco Bay or sitting in a port in Long Beach or Seattle, about how this whole system works, give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Rose George, author of 90% of Everything. Rose, so talk about what are the kind of key issues for workers on board ships today, and to what extent are they able to organize to advocate for their interests?
Well, there is an international transport workers union, the International Transport Workers Federation, which is a global union, represents seafarers. So they can belong to the ITF. A lot of ships have signed up to an ITF agreement, which is supposed to guarantee good conditions. But it's very difficult, because if you have, say, a ship that's going to be flagged to one country, owned by a national of another country, managed by someone in another country, with a crew from five or six different countries, if something goes wrong on the high seas, who do you turn to? And if something goes wrong urgently on the high seas, it's very difficult to get immediate help. Now, the ITF and other unions and a lot of welfare associations who work with seafarers, like, for example, in the U.S., the Seamen's Church of Seamen's Church Institute of New York is very active trying to improve welfare conditions. So there are people working for this. But even today I've had emails from union officials telling me about ships that have been abandoned because companies have gone bankrupt, but because they're outside territorial waters, the nearest port is unable to help them, so they're stuck on the ship for 7 months. Their wages haven't been paid for 7 months. They don't even have fresh water. And so all these emails are flying around saying, you know, we've got to help these guys, but it's a bit ad hoc. So it can be very difficult.
Yeah, actually, I want to take a... We have a call from a listener, Brenda, here in San Francisco. Brenda, welcome to your call.
Good morning. I just tuned in, and my question immediately, my thought was, what can we do for these people, men and women, who are coming into our ports around the country? What can we do to assist those? Now, I just heard you mention, the guest mentioned the Seamen's Church in New York, and I didn't catch the other organizations, but what can we do to assist them? Now, if that answer can be answered, I'd appreciate that. And thank you for this serious discussion. Well, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Brenda. Rose George?
Well, the very straightforward answer is to help any welfare missions working in the port. I don't know exactly who's working in Oakland Port. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of seafarers mission there, which is a center which will be within the dock area where seafarers don't have to travel very far. They can go there. They've usually got internet access. They can phone home. They can Skype. They can browse. Because one of the things which is extraordinary about modern shipping is that only about 12% of seafarers at sea have internet browsing access. They may be able to have dial-up email, but they do not have, say, for example, Skype or browsing or anything like that. So it's very important that when they come ashore, they have internet access and that it's not extortionately priced.
And on the ship you were on, if you wanted to send an email, it went first. You sent it to the captain. The captain sent it out for you, right?
Yes. So he just had dial-up email twice a day, and that was the system for the whole crew. So they had a private mailbox, which the captain couldn't access, but they only had dial-up email access. So they had, you know, very basic communication. I mean, the kind of communication that the average five-year-old today would not be satisfied with. So to answer Brenda's question, what you can do very easily to help is to check out who is working the seafarers missions in Oakland or in wherever you happen to live, and give them some funds, because they are always desperate for funds. They often don't get as much help as they could from shipping companies, and they always need assistance, and they're providing a really, really valuable service.
And as I say, in our audience, we know we have folks who have worked in the shipping industry or who currently work at the Port of Oakland or have interactions with it. If you have questions or comments you want to bring in to talk about any local resources to support sailors who are coming into port here in the Bay Area, we welcome your call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You talk about how isolated sailors can be on these ships, and how if there's a problem, how they just, it's not real clear who has jurisdiction or who they go appeal to. You tell this really remarkable story in one of the chapters of the books, not about what you experienced, obviously, on the Merce Kendall, but about a livestock ship that was going, and I think this just gives people a sense. This is a ship carrying livestock from Uruguay to Lebanon, is that right? That then sunk off of the coast of Lebanon.
Yes, that's right, and more than 45 people drowned in the crew, but it sank just off Lebanon, about 13 miles off Lebanon, so just outside territorial waters. And it was a ship that was flagged to Panama, which has the largest flag registry in the world, the largest shipping fleet in the world. It was called the Danny F2, and I just happened to write about it because I was writing a piece about shipping, and someone said, well, can you just find something that's happened recently and write about that, and I found this ship. And then I contacted the brother of one of the crew members who died, and I started getting emails from other crew members And I found myself in this extraordinary situation that they were asking me to find out what had happened to their relatives because the flag state of Panama had not done an investigation and has, in fact, took about 3.5 to 4 years to provide an investigation into why this apparently safe ship sank and why so many people drowned just off the coast of Lebanon. And Panama now has done the investigation, but is not making it public. Hmm. And there is nothing anyone can do about it.
And this is not uncommon, right? When sailors die or when there's a shipwreck, that it's very hard to get the countries where these ships are flagged to actually do something about it or look into it.
No, normally there is an investigation. It depends.
So
on
it's, this is unusual.
It is unusual, okay. that there is this much obstruction and this much mystery around a ship. That is unusual. Normally, for example, the good flag registries, the good national registries, normally there will be a comprehensive and thorough investigation, and they're very interesting, and the reports are public. For example, in the UK, the MAIB, as it's called, the Investigative Bureau that reports on shipping accidents, does very, very good reports. So you can go to the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, keeps a database, and most of these reports are publicized, and they are now making them public. I just happened upon this case, which just happens to be, for some reason, mysterious, and I don't know why Panama is not releasing the report, but I wish they would, so some of the crew family members, their minds could be at rest.
Rose, we have a call from Andre in San Francisco, who I want to bring on because he's got some relevant information based on what we were talking about earlier. Andre, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Matt. Yes, about 10 years ago, I worked in the port of Oakland at the Maritime Center there. I understand that the Seamen's Church Institute is now in charge of that center. It's on 7th Street, right close to the water. And when I worked there, there was a wonderful retired priest, Father Paul Devine, with the Apostleship of the Sea, a Roman Catholic organization that had done a lot of service to the seafarers in the local area for years and years. He independently would take magazines and phone cards and walk them into these container ships, which, if you've never been into a container ship, there's a lot of stairs. And he would take these things down to the sailors because they were forbidden to get off of the ships in the short time of, less than 24 hours that they were in port. So they had no opportunity to call their loved ones. And they would be on these ships for months and months. And one of the things that they just enjoyed getting the most would be like magazines or books. They had nothing to do in whatever off time they had on those ships. So in response to the call from the earlier woman, yes, there are many things that you can do. Go over to that Seafair Center there at the end of 7th Street in Oakland, and you'll find how you can get in touch with them, or Google the Seamen's Church Institute in Oakland.
You know, Andre, we are going to put some information about that on our website, yourcallradio.org. We'll have it up there shortly after the hour is over. I really thank you so much for calling in and giving those resources. I think this is the kind of thing that people don't even realize this is going on right here nearby. They may see the ships come in and out of the port, but not really understand what's the situation for the sailors who are on those boats, and then what's here in terms of resources for them locally. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're in conversation with Rose George, author of 90% of Everything Inside Shipping, the invisible industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, and food on your plate. We'll be back right after this break.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that depends and relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post your comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call, where today we're talking about what our guest Rose George calls the invisible industry, and that is shipping. She has really gone in depth doing research from a very personal perspective and also more broadly in her new book, 90% of Everything. And you can find more information about this program and everything we do here at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Speaking of which, tomorrow it's our Friday Media Roundtable. And on Monday, on the eve of the beginning of the healthcare exchanges being created by the Affordable Care Act, we are going to take all your questions about what you need to know about Obamacare as it goes into effect. But today we're talking about shipping. If you're someone who, like Andre, has had some kind of interaction with the shipping industry, with people who spend their lives going back and forth in these ships, which really bring us everything that we depend on in our lives, we invite your calls at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you're someone who's just been interested in hearing what Rose George is talking about, maybe you have a question about how this industry works, about the environmental impacts, about piracy, which we're definitely going to talk some about, we welcome your calls as well. 866-798-TALK. Rose, I don't know if you had any response or something you wanted to add based on what Andre was saying about the Seafarer Center and things like that that are here in Oakland.
No, I'm just going to second what you said because I spent quite a lot of time in a port in the UK called Immingham, which is a bulk cargo port, so it's not very pretty. It's got lots of coal dust, but there's an amazing priest there as well called Father Colum, who is one of my heroes, and as Andre was saying, he does an incredible job. He's there every day, day in, day out. He lives in the port, and he spends his days just going and visiting ships, taking them cheap SIM cards, making sure they've got everything, fetching them. He does whatever they need. He goes shopping for them. He goes and puts, you know, if they need batteries, he'll go and put it on his credit card for them. He totally trusts them, and he does an incredible job, and there are lots of chaplains and lay chaplains and volunteers doing that kind of job. Now, the other problem in the U.S., of course, is that since 9/11, the security concerns mean that a lot of seafarers find that they're not allowed ashore at all, and they're actually denied access to U.S. soil. And in studies, a really quite alarming proportion of particularly Pakistani seafarers, particularly people from certain countries that maybe make some alarm bells ring, they're not allowed ashore. So that's a big problem as well.
So what are these folks around the ships going? So they're coming all the way across the Pacific. They get to a port like Oakland or Seattle or Long Beach, and they're staying on ship and then going all the way back.
Yeah, some of them, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable, and you can see why.
Some of them are on 9-10 month contracts.
And where
it doesn't happen in every port.
Right.
I mean, and they will be able to get ashore maybe in Canada, but they may not be allowed ashore in U.S. ports. Can be quite difficult.
So, just ballpark, 9 month contract. How much time are you spending on ship?
Well, there was a professor who did a study of seafarers, and he asked them, and he found one guy who'd not gone ashore for I think 56 days or something.
Yeah.
I think he was an exception. But, okay, so on my ship, which is going Felixstowe, Europe, down to Singapore, sort of coasting India down to Singapore, I could go ashore more than they could, clearly, but they would probably have at the most 3-4 hours ashore, maybe five.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, I want to invite on a couple of listeners who actually have spent quite a bit of time on ships themselves. Paul in San Francisco, welcome to Your Call.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I spent quite a few years on ships in the 70s into the 90s. I've been out of the industry for a while since then. But I'd just like to confirm everything that your guest is saying. But I'd like to make the point that the shipping industry is one of the first that really saw the impact of globalization of the workforce. We American sailors, who used to make good money and had pretty cushy jobs, actually, now we're competing with people that make 10 or 20% of what an American sailor makes, and which is probably the reason why American sailors are disappearing. The only ships that that are manned by American sailors anymore are Jones Act ships, meaning that they run between American ports. That the law is that those ships have to be American flag. So between here and Hawaii or Alaska, those are manned by American sailors, but those are the only ones, and the American sailors have died out completely because of the competition with these very low-paid workers from all of the, from the third world.
And Rose George, you even talk about in your book, 90% of Everything, how this isn't just the folks working below deck, now the officer class as well. There's really this international competition for both skilled and unskilled positions on these ships.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, as your caller was saying, yes, American sailors have been priced out of the market through no fault of their own. Same has happened in the UK and increasingly Western Europe. And I'm talking about both crew and officer class here. And the reason that has happened is indeed because of globalization, but it's because of the flag of convenience. So once a ship owner was able to choose what whatever flag he or she wanted to fly on the ship and needed to have absolutely no link with the country in question. I mean, you can rent a flag from the landlocked country of Bolivia if you want to, or Mongolia, or North Korea has a flag registry. Now, of course, some of these have certain reputations, so hopefully people will go for a good reputation ship. But what these flags routinely do is remove all kind of labor restrictions, all kind of wage restrictions. So, of course, people employ cheaper sailors. And in the case of the Philippines is actually a very active maritime nation, and the government encourages people to go into the maritime industry. So it does keep producing pretty good crew, but increasingly it's producing officer class. And if you talk to any Western European or American officers, then they'll certainly have an opinion on that and on the sort of caliber of officer class that is coming through. But yes, there are waves of labor coming from the developing world, it's a case of you get what you pay for.
Paul, are you still with us?
I am.
I just wanted to ask, just in your time in the industry, how did the kind of work you were doing and what it was like to work in shipping change for you?
Well, it was hard work. I saw the industry changing out of under me, which is part of why I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the jobs disappeared. But I'd like to point out that the shipping industry was one of the very first to be unionized. Back in the latter part of the 19th century, the unions became very strong, especially in San Francisco. But all of that's gone away now. Now the very few remaining jobs there are still unionized, and the workers make very good money. But it's disappearing and almost dead.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you so much for calling and joining the conversation on your call. If you would like to call in with your experience in the shipping industry or you have questions for our guest, Rose George, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's what Patrick did, and he says it's lonely and often dangerous work done by professionals who, for the most part, remain background players in the worldwide distribution network. Without them, however, the backbone of the supply chain would surely crumble. Patrick, thank you so much for that email. Let's go next to Jim in Berkeley, who I understand is a retired merchant seaman. Welcome, Jim.
Hello.
You're on the program. Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello. Listen, I want to concur what Paul was saying. I don't know if I can add a lot to what he said, except that one change I saw over my career, and I'm sure Rose knows this too, is the upgrading in communications. When I first went on deep sea ships, we'd leave port and be a world unto ourselves for months at a time, and the captain would sometimes have to get very dramatic just to get the attention of the home office. But with satellites coming in and other forms of communications, you got more of a micromanagement going on. And one of the reasons that container ships are so efficient is that even their time in port is so managed. So if there's not a slot for you, they'll hold you back, slow you down, so you come right in, go straight to the dock, and be gone in 18 hours. So I saw that big change as she was describing. The time in port is just minimum now. There's so much money involved, and there's so much productivity that's increased. You know, our little ships had 35 people on them, and they're very sociable, and a lot of people that had at least each other, and a lot of good card games and fun and stuff. And I saw that change to where people hardly knew each other when they worked together, because you might see your relief in a day's turnaround, but you know, and eat with somebody for a little while during the day. But it's very isolating, and they had studies made on European ships that people were even being psychologically affected by that kind of work.
Jim,
I think the answer is, like Paul was pointing at, strong unions that have to be globalized, which is hard to do. It's we're behind what the companies can do in terms of they're very global, but I think the workforce hasn't been organized strongly enough. Although, you know, the ITF is and some European and American affiliates are strong, but that's really the answer to get some balance back and get better conditions on those ships, and that's going to take a while.
Jim, I want to get Rose George's response to your point about trying to have more of a global, you know, the global advocacy by unions. But I want to go to Mike in San Francisco, who has a related question about life on board. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question. She mentioned that, you know, these guys work long hours on ship, but, you know, from somebody who don't sail, my point of view is that those guys would load the ship and they sail to the next port and unload the ship. So, number one, what entails, what do they do on the ship between port A and port B? And also, I've heard, you know, stories of like how the ship would sail from point A to point B, depending on the weather. That means it's going to catch a tailwind so that it'll take a shorter time, as opposed to fighting a headwind, basically.
So you're saying, does that mean they have additional time in port or things like that? Is that your question? Or
come again?
What? So just.
Well, my question is, number one, what do they do on ship through the travels from point A to point B?
Great, Rose
okay,
George.
I'm happy to. I'll start with that, because that's quite a lot to answer. So what they do on ship, on my experience on my ship, on the Maersk Candle, what they do is they work, they eat, they sleep. That's it. They may, they all have, for example, the officers have 2 watches a day, 2 4-hour watches. They'll probably do 3 or 4 hours work on top of that. This actually relates to the previous caller's point, which is the micromanagement of a ship. Now, the captain on my ship would spend 7 or 8 hours a day stuck at his desk on his computer, just dealing with shoreside demands and requests. They would all come in that two times he would dial up twice a day, he would get a mountain of things to deal with. He had checklists galore, and he found it incredibly frustrating, because what he wanted to do was be up on the bridge and navigate his ship. He loved navigation. He loved being at sea. I loved being at sea, incidentally. It's a beautiful thing to do, to go to sea. But the trouble is that these guys on the ship, their workload is huge, because these ships, 300 meters long, 7,000 boxes, all those boxes need to be cared for. The ship is constantly being assaulted by salt, by wind, by water. It needs to be chipped of rust and painted constantly. There's always the sound of a drill somewhere on deck. There's always work to be done. The engine room needs to be looked after 24 hours a day. There are constant alarms going off. They are working very hard, these guys, and there are only 19 of them, remember, for that size of a ship. So they are not, they're certainly not lounging around.
When they do have a moment to themselves or hanging out with each other, what do they do?
They go back to their cabins and they watch DVDs. And the previous caller's point about it shipping being much more sociable, that's what anyone who's been at sea for 20, 30 years will say exactly that. They'll say that we used to get together, they used to have films on the deck, you know, someone would rig up a screen and they'd watch films together, but now everybody's got a laptop. So with these kind of modern, what people say, the ills of the antisocial sort of computerization of our lives, that's magnified on a ship. So everybody just goes back to their cabin, they're exhausted, they watch a DVD, they sleep. I mean, I used to time the meals, and I think that's a pretty good indication of how happy people are to be together. And I timed it to about 6 minutes. So nobody was hanging around to interact. Nobody was socializing with each other. They were fueling, going back to their cabins, sleeping, or working.
Rose, I want to bring on a caller who has a question related to another big issue in the book, which is the environmental impacts of the shipping industry. Alan in Monterey, welcome to the program. And if you could be brief, we've got a few other folks after you. I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, great talk. I was curious about the whale, ship strikes. The thread of the conversation seems to be, leaning towards a more speed in this industry. It's always rush, 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 and that's why the ships are striking the whales. They don't seem to slow down. But I understand there's a new whale spotting app, but it's at the whim of cell phone coverage. So who specifically could we lean on as to shipping owners or who in the government do we focus this towards to bring more attention that, I'm going to Pacifica this weekend, and we found a little baby humpback that had been knocked out, and then the propellers ripped them apart at the end. And I tried to get in the Chronicle, and basically they made it into an orca attack. They didn't want to talk about it being a ship strike. So if you could address that, it'd be great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, whale strikes are a problem, and nobody really has numbers because so much happens at sea. And unless a ship reports it or comes into port with a whale direct over its bow, which has happened, we're not going to know about it. So we really rely on injuries from dead whales if they happen to come into shore. But it is a problem. But on the positive side, the shipping industry does care about whales too. I mean, you'll get grouchy shipping columnists saying that they don't, and it's all eco madness. But a lot of seafarers care about whales. They don't want to hit whales. They love ocean life because it's interesting. It makes their lives interesting at sea to see animals and whales and stuff. So they don't want to damage whales. And even though the pace of the industry is so frenetic, there is actually a trend in the industry now to slow down.
And that's partly about cost, right?
That's about fuel costs, but it has a side effect of being better for the environment and better for whales. And also, I think they've just changed off California, I don't know where exactly, but they've just changed the shipping lanes to try and reduce whale strikes. And they also changed the shipping lanes off Boston and Cape Cod as well. So there are efforts being done, but I think, I write about in the book, which is another problem which is even more hidden than whale strikes, which is the acoustic pollution of ships. And that's a really unknown toll of shipping, which is the noise that propellers make underwater, because ocean animals use sound to communicate. And propellers and other man-made activity in the ocean, like seismic surveys and Navy sonar, has really dramatically damaged the acoustic habitat of many whales, like the humpback whale. Some of its habitat, some of them have got a reduced habitat by 90%. So that's a real issue, and I think that needs to be more publicized as well.
Well, another issue that you bring up that, I'll be honest, I just hadn't thought about was the contribution that shipping makes to global greenhouse gases.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, yeah, we talk about air miles, don't we? But we don't really talk about shipping miles. And to be fair, shipping is the greenest of all transport methods.
And when you say that, what does that mean?
Well, it produces more CO2 per ton per mile than, it's about 1,000 times less than an air freight, for example, and it's about 11 times less than trucking. So it is green, but the trouble is there's so much shipping. There's 100,000 vessels at sea, and it was calculated recently that the 15 largest ships at the time, because there are now even larger ones, produced as much greenhouse gas emissions as 15 million cars. So it's an issue. But again, there is good news that it's now being looked at. The IMO, the International Maritime Organization, is now looking at emissions. People are talking about sustainable shipping all the time. So finally, I think we may start thinking about shipping miles and looking at the environmental impact of shipping as well as air miles.
And I should point out the International Maritime Organization, today is World Maritime Day, and they are focusing on sustainability.
They are. World Maritime Day to everyone.
Thanks very much. And I do want to follow up on the question earlier about whales and shipping routes. So what we gather here quickly is that as of June 1st, the three different approaches to the San Francisco Bay are being extended further from the shore in order to protect whales. So just following up on that question, let's hear from our next caller, which is William in San Francisco. Welcome, William.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to just say that I really appreciate the book. I'm from Bulgaria, and I grew up in a port city, and both my brother and dad are officer, so I've lived my entire life in this context. And I wanted to make a quick side comment. The language that develops on these ships is extremely interesting because people are from everywhere. You know, I have people from Bulgaria, Romania, Turkey, India, the Philippines, and nobody really speaks good English there, not even the officers on many of the ships. So they sort of superimpose their languages on top of English to create this pidgin or Creole, which is understandable only to them, only within that context. And whenever I visited the ship, I've never been able to understand what, you know, they're talking about. So I just wanted to say that's very interesting from a linguistic point.
Rose, when you were on the Merce Kendall, what was your experience with that?
That's a really interesting point, actually. I had, unusually, the Merce Kendall was a British flagged ship. There aren't many of those left, but it was unusually one of those. So the captain and the chief engineer were British, so I understood them fine, even though the captain was from the northeast of England, and they have quite a strong accent. But otherwise we had a chief officer who was Indian, but obviously very good Indian English. But yes, it can be a problem. And there is actually, if you listen to the VHF radio on the bridge, then you can, I found myself absolutely baffled by most of it. You've got Chinese sailors, Filipino sailors, Pakistani Burmese, all speaking, as your caller just said, a very strange kind of English. And it does kind of work, but not always. And there is actually, academics have developed something called Maritime English. And there's another language called Sea Speak. And they try and simplify English so that this incredibly polyglot, multinational workforce can communicate more efficiently, but it's a serious point. I mean, if you're stuck in a situation in a storm at sea, you really want to understand your engineer down in the engine room immediately, don't you?
Rose George, author of 90% of Everything. We are nearly out of our time here on Your Call today, but I want to talk about a subject that actually is one of the elements of the shipping industry that has gotten a lot more attention in recent years, and that is piracy. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how your perspective on piracy changed from doing this research, and also what you write about on the New Yorker's website that folks can see, link from our website, yourcallradio.org, about how some of the measures to counter piracy are really having an effect.
Sure. Well, piracy was one of the reasons that I got interested in shipping, because I just came across this figure that, well, in 2010, when I was trying to go to sea on Merce Kendall, 544 seafarers were being held hostage. And I learned this figure, and I just thought, that is incredible. And why was it not getting any attention? And I thought, well, you know, it wouldn't happen in any other industry, 544 airline pilots or bus drivers. It just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't be tolerated. So I went to sea thinking of that, and I actually went through pirate zones on Merce Kendall, but the ship was big enough that it was considered safe. So then I went back to sea on a counter-piracy warship, and we traveled from Mombasa to Mogadishu. It's on a Portuguese warship. And that was really, really instructive, because I was with the military, and they'd been trying to fight pirates, and they had really interesting perspective. They were actually not sympathetic, but they were saying, well, you know, it's a very poor country, Somalia. It's a broken country. It's spitting out these young men going to attack ships. And they were, I was far less sympathetic than they were. Now, fast forward to today, and there hasn't been an attack on a big ship since May 2012. So that piece that you mentioned, The New Yorker, I was looking at what are the factors that have reduced Somali piracy. And I actually think that the biggest and simplest answer is that many more ships now carry armed guards, and pirates don't want to die, so if they get fired upon, then they will retreat, and that's a very simple truth. But I was looking at the fact that the U.S. Has now done 28 prosecutions and got 28 convictions of Somali pirates on U.S. soil, and that's the first time since 1820, so that's pretty monumental and interesting. So,
and that was dependent on the fact that these pirates had gone on board a U.S. flagged ship, right?
Yeah, they attacked the Maersk Alabama, which was attacked in 2009, and its captain Phillips, was taken hostage on a lifeboat for 5 days. And once that was the first time that a U.S. flagged ship had been attacked, and once that happened, then what the U.S. had been doing before, like many other European and NATO countries, was delegating prosecution of pirates to Kenya, the Seychelles, Mauritius, local regional countries. They didn't want the expense. They didn't want to have these pirates in their prisons. They didn't want to deal with them after they left prison. But once Alabama was attacked, then the U.S. decided that it was going to prosecute Somali pirates on its soil, and it did, and with great zeal, actually, and quite very, very severe penalties.
Well, you can read more about that in Rose George's latest piece for The New Yorker, which you can see linked at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, who have been sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. Rose George's book is 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the Invisible Industry that Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. Rose, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It's a really fascinating book.
My pleasure. Could I just recommend everybody on World Maritime Day, you can go to see on cargo ships and container ships, and I recommend it. It really is a wonderful trip.
You can ride along. Great. Thank you so much, Rose. I'm Matt Martin, and I'll be back in a moment to let you know what we have in store for tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, coverage focused on last-ditch efforts to defund Obamacare and the approaching showdown over the debt ceiling. How are media contextualizing the debate on Capitol Hill? We'll also hear about an in-depth investigation into how Detroit went broke. Join the conversation with John Gallagher of the Detroit Free Press and Huffington Post Washington correspondent Michael McAuliffe. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. We'll be right back.